Here's the reality with GLP-1s. Demand is surging, payer coverage can be complicated, and your patients need to actually start and stay on their therapy to make it work. Amazon Pharmacy makes it simple. Commercial, Medicare, or self-pay, Amazon Pharmacy supports the prior authorization process and handles claims and home delivery. For Medicare patients, the Bridge program means eligible GLP-1s for a flat $50 a month delivered to their door. And licensed pharmacists are available 24/7 for clinical questions. You prescribe, Amazon Pharmacy handles everything else. For more episodes just like this one on a weekly basis, subscribe to RLRCPSolvers.com. You will not regret it.
Reza loves Robbie, or Robbie loves Reza. It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver. Robbie, just seeing you gives me so much energy, man. And that woo, you going the extra effort, knowing I'm on service.
Yes,
Prof. That's when you know you're brotherly.
Prof. Rez, you know, guys, you should know Prof. When Prof. Rez is taking care of patients, those words are like, it's, you know, most of us, when we're taking care of patients, we're like half taking care, you know, like the word taking care, like a parent takes care of their children. Not that Prof. Rez uses patients as his children, but I bet you they're getting the same dedication that he would if he had kids or his current animal kids. So yeah,
Where was I going,
Prof. Rez? What was I talking about? I have no idea.
You sound like Prof. Rez right now, and you know under what circumstance. I wanted to share a story with you, but before I do that, we're at almost 1,700 books sold.
Really?
30 reviews. And like someone named Matthew put the loveliest review today.
Really? What did Matthew say?
Oh my gosh. You have to go look at it on Amazon review. But this is all to say, we really want to get to 40 reviews within 2 months. We're at 30. So if the people listening can help us achieve that, and if you really found the book useful, please share it with a colleague. Our goal is to get to 3,000 by the end of the year, but help us get to 2,000 first. Because in order to walk a mile, you got to walk a step first.
Mm. And if you haven't read the book or even bought the book, just write a review. It's okay. It's no problem. Wait, you probably can't write a review, right? You have to like verify.
You can. It's just not a verified purchase.
Yeah, guys, what are you doing? Just write a review. Come on.
Anyway. I almost wrote a review, but then in my conscience was like, no, it's not right.
I think
I'm gonna put Reza Manesh. This is the best book. Without this book, you can't practice medicine.
Dude, I'm gonna write a review as Reba or Rezi.
But Robbie, can I share a quick story with you before we dive? Because we have quite a bit to cover today in a really good way. I think you and the audience are gonna really enjoy today's session, like most sessions, but today I came on rounds. We have a patient who was admitted with a lung nodule, FDG avid, got a EBUS biopsy, and unfortunately, it was complicated by an iatrogenic pneumothorax. And Palm has been managing the chest tube, and you know, we've been following their recs. And every day, like for the last probably 5 or 6 days, he's had this like low grade on and off sinus tachycardia, like 184. We get there this morning and we've talked about the causes of sinus tach, and we look at his chart from like a year ago and he has this low grade tachycardia, like 90, 100, et cetera. So it's pre-existing. The biopsy ends up returning as adenocarcinoma, but luckily no disease elsewhere. So like, I think there can still be a curative attempt. This morning, something spectacular happened. As the medical student was presenting the case, he did such a phenomenal job. And I said, hey, what do you think about the tachycardia? And he listed, you know, the DDX for that. And then I shared, like, you know, hypovolemia. And people were saying he's anxious. And he himself is saying, I'm anxious in front of doctors. And he has those moments where he's normal heart rate, right? And then all of a sudden, you came into my mind. Like, guys, remember, he's a little fast, but it's at rest. He's not even exerting himself. And then I say, the list for Sinus Tach Cardia, and then the intern Danny, she's like, wait a minute, why isn't this a PE? And I was like, so her asking that was a great thing. And then if I was a younger attending, I think I would have been like defensive, like, why didn't I think of that? And I would have been like, oh, it's not a PE. He had prior sinus tachycardia. I didn't do that. I said, Danny, why do you ask? She's like, well, we have a new diagnosis of cancer and we have tachycardia. And I'm like, this is such a good question. And I was under the impression he already had a CTA, part of his screening, but it was a PET CT. And then I look at the team and then I'm like, okay, guys, what do you want to do? And then we look at the chart and we're like, oh, he had prior tachycardia. We're like, should we just get a D-dimer? And if it's negative, because he had a prior history of tachycardia before coming to the hospital, we can sort of chalk it up that like he just has long-standing tachycardia. But if it's positive, then we'll go down the CTPE protocol. So the D-dimer ends up being really high. We end up proceeding with the CTPE protocol. And then it's like all those cases, right, where you don't think it's going to be a PE and then it is. And the reason I say that is because, again, he had long-standing history of tachycardia. He looks so good. No shortness of breath, no chest, nothing. No. Dude, he's laughing. He can't wait to leave the hospital. And then before the teleradiologist calls us, I looked at the CTPE.
Really, Prof.
And because of you, man, I'm like, there's a segmental extensive filling defect on the
Oh,
right.
nice
The
job.
RV is the same size as the LV. I think there's right heart strain. And then right when we say that, we get a hold of the radiologist who echoes everything I say.
Nice. Oh, man, I'm so proud of you.
Man, and I told the team, look how proud of you guys are. I'm like, first, the med student detected the tachycardia, didn't dismiss it. The intern asked a phenomenal question, why can't it be a PE? And then the attending had no ego. It's like, you're right. So for 4 or 5 days, he probably had that clot. And we're diagnosing it. And now we have to decide heparin or Lovenox with the chest tube. And we're going to touch base with Palm to make that
Such a
decision.
cool story. That's such a cool story. There's nothing. Me reflecting on that just wastes time. That is so beautiful and so powerful in so many ways. Kudos to all of you. And yeah, what a sneaky diagnosis, Prof. Rez. It's like honestly the most, yeah, it's the chameleon of medicine. Jeez.
How easy is it, like, if the patient was coming to the ED with tachycardia and a lung knot, like, you'll be like, let's get a CT,
Effortless.
but in the hospital, on and off, not full blown, and prior chart showing tachycardia, to be like, ultimately he has a cancer, we have to do it. We use a D-dimer. You could argue maybe you didn't need to use that, but I'm just all around so proud of my team, man.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing, Prof. Rez. You know, it's also humbling to me. I'm learning more and more medical reflection with you. I used to think that like thromboembolism risk was a was proportional to the burden of tumor. And that remains a fact. I was reflecting on this, Prof. Rez, because on Friday we missed you for VMR. We had an incredible case presented by Aaron, where a 60-year-old woman presented with May Thurner. And the question became why May, sorry, why am I saying May Thurner with like phlegmasia pseudodolorens with ischemia? And we were like, May Thurner, why is she presenting at 60? They couldn't find anything. 1 year later, her endometrial cancer blossomed and she had overt endometrial cancer. She asked herself, what is a normal time for development of endometrial cancer from precancerous to lead? It's like 3, 4 years. So she had it the whole time. And I learned from that that like the risk of thromboembolism is definitely increases with degree of cancer, but it begins at a high rate for adenocarcinomas, even when they're occult. And so we have this like really cool model of autoimmune diseases like dermatomyositis having paraneoplastic effect for years before the cancer becomes obvious. And apparently that's also true for thromboembolism. So you know how you say you should only do age-appropriate cancer screening, but you should continue to maintain vigilance for 1 year because the risk of cancer is 17-fold higher in people with over 50 who have unprovoked venous thromboembolism. So if you just like if you just play if you do this case in reverse and say you didn't know about the lung nodule, it's tiny. He obviously didn't feel the lung nodule, right? If you if he just came in with shortness of breath or whatever, you would have diagnosed the PE, and what's causing it is a tiny little resectable lung cancer. It's crazy. But that was a really interesting thing I've learned recently. It's not correct to think proportionate. Really, small tumors can cause crazy clots.
Dude, I wish you were in the team room with us because that comment just gave me goosebumps. Yeah, this is the smallest lung nodule of
Crazy,
prostate.
right?
And
Crazy.
but the PE is very large PE,
RV
like
strain.
right heart strain. Yeah.
Crazy. Really humbling. Learning is endless, Prof. It's literally endless. 10 years in, when we're learning like what seems to be a basic concept in medicine,
Robbie, we got two cases for you, and I'm still going to
Whoa.
present both. We have time. The first one's a mini case, and then the
Okay.
second one is the actual case. And I'm going to take you right to the, for the first one, just one aliquot and then your
Okay.
discussion. It's an individual who's in his 60s, and he has a history of a total hip arthroplasty. He ends up developing, hip pain, comes to the hospital, gets blood cultures, ends up growing salmonella in like 4 out of 4.
Whoa.
Eventually, this speciates to non-typhoidal, and we're not exactly sure what happened, but somehow the salmonella became bacteremia and seeded this paraprosthetic joint. So he gets started on 2 grams of ceftriaxone, is doing well. We take over his care after he has the hardware removed, a spacer placed, and a washout performed. This was like 2 days prior, and then he's on our service from the ICU. And I look at his labs, and this is what struck me as unusual. Prior, early on in the hospitalization, his liver chemistry test was normal, 100% normal. Now his AST is like 167, ALT is like 80, Alk Phos is 300, and bilirubin is normal. He's on ceftriaxone, he had this procedure. I want to hand the mic to you. I don't expect you to get an answer, but what would you be most worried about? How would you manage this? Any other tests you would send?
I'm always really glad whenever their liver injury is never severe enough to impact a synthetic function, as it is in this case. But that should make you caution to make sure it is the liver. And so whenever I see these numbers, I'm always making sure it's not the muscle. But here, the elevated Alk Phos makes that much less likely. So now you're focusing in on the liver, and the first question is what part, the actual parenchyma or the biliary drainage system? And I think that the biliary drainage system, usually when it presents acutely like this, when you have the time course, it's acute and more prominent. The enzymes are higher, and the patient has pain. So I think the localization here is likely intrahepatic, as opposed to extrahepatic. So just to recap real quick, could have been the muscle, but Alk Phos makes that less likely. Can be the extrahepatic biliary tree still, but whenever you have acute extrahepatic biliary disease, the patient and the lab tends to be more prominent. So you're in the liver itself. And what you have here is an interesting pattern. It seems to be that they're hepatocellular and the cholestasis seems to be equally prominent. So I'd say this is a mixed hepatocellular injury. And this is very, very suggestive acutely of drug-induced liver injury, which is by far and away the most common cause of hospital-acquired intrahepatic cholestasis. So just that alone, Prof. Reds, I think I'd be most suspicious of ceftriaxone, but I think there's a very traditional workup that we do for these patients that you probably would start doing at this point.
What is that work of?
Yeah, so I think you would send off viral hepatitis serology as a Tylenol level as a base place to start, and then different people go to different levels. Some people go absolutely bananas, and we're doing alpha 1 antitrypsin testing.
Yo,
But I think,
not Prof. Res, baby.
yeah, but I think I would probably do an imaging
Gotcha.
to start. The
Beautiful.
goal of imaging is to make sure that there's two things. We often emphasize it's to make sure that there's no extrahepatic biliary disease, but it's also you want to make sure that there's no space occupying intrahepatic biliary disease. And the reason I say that is he's got salmonella in his hip. Could he have a subtle liver abscess here that has been undetected? That's the role of imaging here.
Beautiful. And I will tell you, because of the salmonella, they did a TTE, then a TEE, then a
Wow.
CTA of the chest because of this tropism for the vasculature. So, Robbie, as you know, our VA has contracted GPT. So, we have a HIPAA compliant version for just some faculty. I was lucky enough to be part of the faculty members that has this access. So, I can copy paste notes into that GPT, which is supposed to expire in September. I hope they renew it because it has really transformed the care I provide to patients. So in the GPT, I had put in the orthopedic surgery note. I put in all the notes, so it had all the data points. I said, GPT, what do you make of these liver chemistry test abnormality? They said the following. They said, in reading the ortho note, there was a lot of manipulation of both muscle and bone.
Oh,
There is a
interesting.
possibility that the AST and ALT reflect muscle and that the alk phos reflects the skeleton from the manipulation. Send a CK and send a GGT.
That's so cool.
Ceftriaxone may cause sludge and can cause biliary obstruction. Get a right upper quadrant ultrasound. Talk to ID. I send a CK. We send a CK. It comes back at 4,000.
No way! This is so cool.
The GGT is also elevated. So it's not true that the GGT was not up. So the
Oh,
alk phos, but we
still.
continued ceftriaxone. The ultrasound, the right upper quadrant was totally normal. ASC, ALT, and alk phos are all downtrending.
Amazing. That's so cool.
Within a second, GPT read the, I would have
No, that's
never read that
incredible.
detail of the ortho
No.
note.
I'm
And
surprised Ortho was that honest, to
they were like, there was so
honest.
much manipulation, and this is a
Really?
well-known phenomenon, both alk phos and, but send a CK
I
and the
never heard of it.
GGT.
That's so cool, man. Wow.
Well known to GPT and the ortho world, unknown to Reza
Man.
Manesh and Prof. Robs.
100%. That's so cool.
So there's so many instances, Robbie, I can share right now how GPT has made me feel like I'm providing the best care I've ever provided to
That's
patients.
awesome, man.
And without like second guessing, emotional burnout, like it's my all, and I can even ask questions better of consultants. Rather than tell you another story about GPT, let
Can I
me
ask
tell
you one
you,
follow-up question? I'm
oh,
curious,
please.
did you ask GPT where the what about the GGT? Is there learning embedded with that, or was there?
Oh, they said you can't deny that there's something going on in the liver because of the
Gotcha.
GGT, but yeah, like I'm not sure
Okay.
exactly. But we do have the ultrasound, which
Can
is
I tell you
normal.
some an observation? I'm gonna try
Yes,
to.
please.
I've noticed GGT be noisy sometimes. Like I've seen cases where it's
Wow.
obviously coming from the bone as the predominant disease. I've started to have like this little bit of a doubt about how specific GGT is, to be
Me
honest.
too, I swear to you.
Yeah.
It happened to me just a
Yeah.
couple weeks ago.
Really?
I promise you. And I was like, wait a minute, this makes no sense because there's
Yeah.
like an obvious bone source. Why
Yeah.
is it GGT up?
I don't know if I trust it as much. Now I have to like, now this case is fueling me to deliberately, like, it's the only outlier here. And I think, yeah. Okay. I know we have another case to get to. We'll put that
Yeah.
aside. But
All right. A patient in their mid-30s
yeah.
presents to the emergency department with 3 to 4 days of an occipital headache. Vitals are fine, looks good. Is given sort of the migraine cocktail. The headache gets better. She's discharged. Returns back saying the headache has returned the next day. Now, at this point, her temperature is 101. She has mild tachycardia. And again, she describes this as like a headache that's just getting worse. And the meds temporize the headache that she
Yeah.
received yesterday, but it's back. And she just feels like I feel a little mentally cloudy. And on exam, there is, there is no rash, there's no belly pain. The lights are off because she has photophobia, and she actually has phonophobia too. And she says she has some neck stiffness. So now I'm going to pass you the mic. That's aliquot
Yeah.
one.
Yeah, you know, I think that when somebody has such a foggy presentation with fever, the probability of a viral infection is exceptionally high. The disease is not dominated by focality or hecticness. It's dominated by discomfort. And I think there's only one open question is where, at least initially, one open question is where is this viral infection? And I think it's a 50-50 coin toss initially about it being a diffuse viral infection like COVID or the flu, or it being meningeal. And I think many causes of COVID or flu will make people uncomfortable, but maybe not to the degree of having such prominent localizing symptoms, especially the photophobia, phonophobia, and meningismus. So while I don't, while you know, I think we tend to equate meningitis and the word meningitis tends to be concerning. I think she probably has it, but I think the nature of her disease is very likely viral meningitis. And I think the only thing that is really important now is to ask ourselves, are we really minimizing her mental fogginess and does she have encephalitis? And the difference between meningitis and encephalitis in terms of microbiology isn't really very, very different, but the efficacy of treatment is. So you can't really offer anybody any treatment for viral meningoencephalitis except acyclovir. Everything else is tenuous and plus minus. But the evidence for IV acyclovir for HSV meningitis is zero. It doesn't really help patients recover faster, but IV acyclovir is life-saving for encephalitis. And so I think Profrez, Honestly, what I would do at this point is, this is one of those times where you probably should have a low threshold to do a lumbar puncture, and you should probably be open to this idea that this is viral, maybe change radically once you get the labs back, because you expect the labs to be boring, if this is viral. And her presentation is at a very gentle tempo, so those are the things that I'd be thinking in the first hour of seeing her.
I never got your take on this, but as far as like she's in your ED, this is the HPI. Do you obtain a CT of head before you do the LP?
Great
And then
question.
what meds are you starting and why?
So the goal of getting a CT is to make sure the patient doesn't have a focal lesion. And I think a focal lesion in such a young, healthy person would be obvious. So I wouldn't get a CT in her. And if you look at the criteria, there was 5 criteria points that a Swedish study recently studied and actually showed that they're excessive. And so I'll share that. Maybe I can actually share that as the schema of like the thought train of meningoencephalitis. So in her, I don't think I would get a head CT because the probability of focality is exceptionally low. Now, if she were older, immunocompromised, there are obvious signs of focality, like focal deficits, seizure, and then there's humbly accepting that you may not have the ability to detect focality because if somebody's older or immunocompromised and may not declare it as easily. But her, I don't think anything applies. I wouldn't fault anybody for getting a head CT in this patient because I think you can take your time diagnosing her. What would I start with her? What would I start for her empirically? Quite honestly, nothing. And this is counterintuitive, and I acknowledge it's very, very counterintuitive because while I'm very suspicious of meningoencephalitis, I have very little suspicion for bacterial meningoencephalitis in the absence of any systemic features. So the bundle to offer somebody for whom you're a little bit more open to bacterial infections is to first get blood cultures, then do dexamethasone, then do vancomycin, ceftriaxone, plus minus ampicillin, and then acyclovir. And there's reasons for all those things. But in her presentation is so gentle. No, she literally at bacterial meningitis, you do not walk into the hospital on hospital day two. You cannot walk. It's this very severe, rapidly progressive illness. Now, you don't want to have the overconfidence to rely on the HPI to exclude a sinister diagnosis like that. But what I'm expecting is 1 hour from now, her labs will be reinforcing this very gentle presentation. And if that's different, I'm going back and doing everything that I said I won't do. But I think this disease is at least 48 hours old. And so you have till hour 49 to reaffirm her stability. And so I would actually start nothing. And then I would get her LP and I would see what she has because she easily could have a negative LP. And if her LP is negative, then I'm not starting anything. If her LP is positive and she doesn't have encephalitis, I would probably be too scared and I would probably start her on acyclovir, but I wouldn't really know what return on investment that's getting her, but I'd call ID to help me adjudicate that.
Well, your discussion is so rich. I actually just learned like a couple of days ago that it's not a strong recommendation. Like it's when we start empiric treatment for meningitis, yeah, the vanc, the ceftriaxone, the dexamethasone, that's all strong, and maybe ampicillin if the right age or risk factors. But acyclovir is specifically for encephalitis, not meningitis. I didn't know that, and you explained that, and so. If you can show that someone doesn't have a seizure or focal abnormality, isn't confused, and really just has the neck stiffness, is that right? Then you can justify not doing acyclovir in that context.
Totally. And Prof. Rez, this sounds crazy, but you can justify discharge. You know,
And
like
I'm going to share with you why your instinct is so right, but not yet. But it's just amazing to just, yeah, it's you're doing such a good job. So she gets started on, vancomycin, ceftriaxone, acyclovir, and dexamethasone. If you don't mind, very briefly, why vanc, ceftriaxone, and dexamethasone?
In the world of suspicion for bacterial meningitis, but I should just say one thing. Never fault anybody for doing excess for a sinister diagnosis, ever. I'm 12 years in, and so I developed this comfort over time in the ER. I think whatever this person is doing, they have their best intent in mind. What they're trying to do, Prof. Rez, is they're empirically treating bacterial meningitis. And the first thing you want to do is to make sure that the patient doesn't have a vigorous inflammatory response. So dexamethasone has data that suggests that patients' morbidity improves if it's given before the antibiotics. So the idea that it tames down the release and the fight of the immune system. Ceftriaxone is given to treat the most common cause of community-acquired meningitis in almost all age groups, which is to treat Streptococcus pneumoniae. Vancomycin is intended not to treat anything else, but to treat a small number, about 1% of strep pneumo that tends to be ceftriaxone resistant, because you can't take any gambles on that. So that's the vancomycin ceftriaxone. And it so happens that ceftriaxone also covers these other major player in community-acquired meningitis, which is Neisseria meningitidis, which would be, based on her age, a plausible diagnosis. And then the ampicillin is used in select patient populations who are at risk of listeria. Listeria doesn't affect everybody. It only affects people who are vulnerable, unlike strep pneumo or Neisseria, which can strike on anyone. So that's the rationale for those.
Beautiful. So she undergoes an LP with these, they got the blood culture, they initiated this, the dexamethasone, all the antibiotics, then they got the LP.
CT or no CT before? How do they play the game?
The CTA was negative.
But they did it before the LP, huh?
Before the LP,
Okay,
yeah.
yeah.
I think they did the CT, not so much like they, yeah, I think just for the head, I'm not
For
sure.
headache, I see.
Yeah, for headache.
Okay.
And it's right, you would never delay the antibiotics for the LP, you would definitely get the blood culture and just initiate the antibiotic and then do the LP in that order. So the CSF, I'm going to give it to you and then have you interpret. 100 white cells, 80% neutrophils, elevated protein, but the glucose is exactly what you would expect it to be based on the serum glucose.
Beautiful.
So not hypoglycorachia.
Nice.
I'm
Wow.
practicing. What was the other word that I struggled with?
Cannabinoids.
Cannabinoids.
You know why I know that is, actually, I'll tell you next week.
Okay.
Oh man, it's right off my tongue, Prof. Rez. I literally was drawing a schema about it before my nap. So let me tell you, if you receive the result, I'll tell you that this overall LP is really reassuring, but there's a moment to practice here. Let's pretend you got the neutrophil count first. The neutrophilia should make you really, really worried, because neutrophilia is a marker of exogenous organisms, of extracellular organisms. And in the world of bacterial meningitis, whenever you hear neutrophilia, you should always, always, always think bacteria. In fact, every other result except neutrophilia is a strong argument against pyogenic bacterial meningitis. So if we hear lymphocytes, neutrophils, monocytes, you don't even have to think about bacterial meningitis. So let's start with the worst case scenario, is maybe the lab accidentally calls you and say, "Hey, she has mostly neutrophils." You should panic. But the reason you go from panic to gentleness is that the vast majority of patients with bacterial meningitis have an extremely high white count, over 500, sometimes over 1,000. And then the absolute majority will have low glucose in their CSF. So even though she has neutrophilia, she doesn't have the height of the white count, nor does she have the depth or the deficiency of the glucose to argue for bacterial meningitis. The good news is that you'll have a CSF Gram stain to reinforce your suspicion. So that is something that you'll have. So you may ask, why is she having a neutrophilic response? And I think the neutrophilic response is a marker of how early she is in her disease. Almost all causes of viral meningoencephalitis have neutrophilic pleocytosis in the first 48 to 72 hours of the disease. And then if you have any uncertainty, what you will see is, on repeat lumbar puncture, those neutrophils will turn into lymphocytes. And the reason for that is that neutrophils are ready, right there, ready to demarginate and attack anything it can. It takes time to send lymphocytes into tissues. So I would interpret this with great reassurance. And I think now, if you're being by the guidelines, you would stop all antibiotics, and then you would scratch your head about what to do with acyclovir. For me personally, Prof. Rez, I'll tell you where I'm at. I'm so the tools of medicine are so sharp, and sometimes you literally need to use them to cut out disease out of a patient, literally. But if a patient has no disease, you end up injuring the patient. And so for me, I think the tools that we have in this instance are too sharp for whatever disease she has. So I would probably just let her be and probably just give her symptomatic treatment. But I understand that may be an outlier here. But yeah, very reassuring LP.
That is spot on. I will tell you that the patient themselves, it was very important to them that they understand why this happened. Like they wanted a definitive
Beautiful.
diagnosis. And the night admitting resident did such a phenomenal job. Like in addition to getting, all the tests, he specifically got a VZV and an
Nice.
HSV off the of CSF. And I told the patient that, there's a good chance we won't know why it happened, but we can rule out the life-threatening causes. And they really didn't want to leave until they had a
Okay, I
definitive
see.
answer.
Which
But my question for you is this, is
yeah.
that I actually was talking to GPT and I was like, what do you think? I had a suspicion based on the history I'm about to provide you of what the
Yeah.
organism might be.
Right.
And then GPT said, hey, make sure that they sent the biofire. If you don't mind explaining what the biofire is, by the way, it wasn't sent. So the VZV and HS, but the biofire wasn't sent. And
Yeah.
to just foreshadow a bit, the medical student made sure that it did get sent. So you will have an answer. So what the biofire is, and it was really important to the patient. And we still had them on the antimicrobial. I just don't have as much experience. But like I was leaving the 48-hour, probably erroneous. I was using that as my landmark, but I really didn't feel this was pyogenic based on everything you said, the subacute course, the number of white cells. We also checked, make sure that there wasn't an immunocompromised state in this patient. But this is the other additional history before you name the organism and explain the biofire. She was around a lot of young kids, and many of them were sick.
Yeah, I don't know for sure preference. Yeah, I think if you just take the epidemiology of meningoencephalitis comes from two sources, people or zoonotic exposures. And I think when people are in urban areas like you and I are, the probability of zoonotic exposures like West Nile, so on and so forth, is not zero, but it's much less than we're outdoors and getting bitten often by mosquitoes and then by ticks. So really the range of possibilities are the most, I'd say the most important sort of like the two H's are the most important, herpes, zoster and VZV, because you can treat them if they become serious, and then HIV because it's a life-changing diagnosis for people. But one of the most common are enteroviruses and a whole family of enteroviruses. So I think based on the kids being sick, I suspect she has that. But a lot of people you never know. And I think what's happening with a biofire is that number of idiopathic and unknown is gradually diminishing. And so I don't have a rich understanding of the biofire prophres in terms of what the test is, but it's essentially a very broad-based PCR panel that tests for a wide variety of targeted testing for a wide variety of viruses all in one swoop on the same test. It has revolutionized the diagnosis of respiratory and GI illnesses, and I've never used it myself, but based on a couple of VMR cases, I've seen it be really cool in terms of giving people an answer for what the cause of
I
their.
love you say you don't know. Dude, I have zero to add. If anything, I'm going to try to copy that the next time I talk about the biofire. But in the biofire for a CSF is different than for the stool, the GI panel.
Yeah.
It's like targeted,
Right.
organisms. And man, like this makes me so happy because the biofire that the med student added, and it was so important to the patient to have an answer, ended up being enterovirus. And I quickly called Kevin, an ID doctor here. And I'm like, Kevin, I have you on speakerphone with the team. He's like, Reza, I have you on speakerphone with my son who I just picked up from daycare, named Simon. I was like, hi, Simon. He's like, hi. And I just want to know for like contact precautions, what needs to be done. Of course, I open evidenced it and everything that open evidence said, Kevin, confirmed. It's just good washing of the hands.
Yeah.
And because it's like, fecal oral route of transmission. And then for her not to go around little kids under 8 weeks because they can have a devastating disease
Oh.
from enterovirus and to not prepare food for others. But we were able to stop all the antibiotics, give her a diagnosis, and discharge her that very day of admission.
Incredible. Well, wait, the
That very
biofire came
day, because
back that quickly.
biofire comes back within 30 minutes, like once we send it.
Wow.
Dude, it's revolutionized. Like when you get these blood cultures that are positive, our lab automatically reflexes the biofire. Within an hour, you know the organism with very high accuracy.
Damn. Sounds like fire the patient basically with the diagnosis right away. That's so cool. That is unbelievable 21st century care progress for somebody to come in, get a lumbar puncture, get a result, get a bug, get unfortunately, I think with how ballooning ERs are, her story of being stuck in the ER is increasingly common, but that's just such a great care.
The act of no, like her knowing gave her so much
Yeah, that's
reassurance. And
wonderful.
like this is spreading throughout the family. and like precautions for others so that it doesn't get transmitted. So it's not just for her own sake. But I would love for you to maybe just summarize like a few from the first case, the second case, anything you have to share before we sign out.
I think that my biggest reflection is just the tools that were available to us in the 21st century are unreal, both like cognitive tools with ChatGPT and diagnostic tools with BioFire. And I think so many people are so scared of what they'll do to us, but I think the last hour has reinforced what I think and what I know you think they'll do to us. They'll enrich our lives, make our patients happier, make us better, stronger, and wiser. And if it weren't for ChatGPT, I would never have learned this mechanism that Ortho made the liver, quote unquote, appear unhappy, and we would never probably know that she had enterovirus. And both of those things are thanks to the technology. So I hope it stays in its lane and doesn't completely take over. But so far, so good, I'd say, Prof.
Dude, before you do, just in 20 seconds, when I came on service, one of the patients had hypotension, really complicated history. And then I went back to my room and like we did a rapid response. We did everything we would do for hypotension, but GPT, I had put all the input, so it knew everything. It said, "Hey, Reza, psych put this patient on a clonidine patch because of so and so. Remove that." I'm like, "Wait, the patient?" And I was like, "Oh, shoot, the patient's on a clonidine patch." When the
Ooh,
patient
still
got
on him?
admitted, someone, because of like their gastric discomfort, they had held the fludrocortisone and midodrine. I had no idea. So
Wow.
basically, we removed the clonidine patch, restarted the fludrocortisone and midodrine, and everything normalized.
Crazy, man.
Because it can keep track of every single data point.
100%. Oh my gosh. That's incredible. Literally saved a life in this, or almost saved a life. Hey, ChatGPT, hat tip to you. This episode is sponsored by ChatGPT. Leave a review.
That's a wrap, folks.